the President of the United States is lying about the FBI, attacking the FBI, and attacking the rule of law in this country? How does that make any sense at all?
Oh, because it's Monday. Or Tuesday. Or Wednesday. Or Thursday. Whenever.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me. Jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Here I am.
Yes, I'm stuck in the middle.
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, 98.7 in Santa Barbara, 93.7 in San Diego, 99.5 FM in Ridgecrest and China Lake, California. Also in California on Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI, Round Mountains KKRN, and Eureka's KGOE. In Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, Eugene's KEPW. In Lancaster, Pennsylvania on WLRI, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, Columbus, Ohio's WGRN. In Palinville, New York on WLPP, Grand Rapids, Michigan's WPRR. In New Orleans on WHIV, Gallup, New Mexico's KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN. In Fayetteville, Arkansas on KPSQ. In Seattle on KODX, in Goldendale, Washington on KVGD, and in Minneapolis, St. Paul on AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day for you on the internets, on the Progressive Voices Channel, Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, GDPR, Revolution 99, Workforce Rising, Deprogrammed Radio, and Detour Talk. Blanketing Planet Earth 5 days a week, I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today. Coming up in a bit, we will try to catch up as much as possible on the fire hydrant of news unleashed on late Friday, over the weekend, and continuing today, on everything from the long overdue announced resignation of Donald Trump's corrupt Interior Department secretary to the case filed by Republicans against Obamacare, which a federal judge in Texas found in favor of, incredibly, late on Friday, ruling the entire Affordable Care Act somehow unconstitutional. We'll try to get to what that means for you and doesn't, mostly doesn't. A couple of new reports from the bipartisan Senate Intelligence Committee arguing that Russia's influence on social media platforms in favor of Donald Trump, both before and after the 2016 election, was far greater than previously reported publicly. Plus, as time allows, maybe, hopefully, some updates on the story that we've been covering very closely here for the past several weeks regarding the massive North Carolina GOP absentee ballot election fraud scandal in the U.S. House District 9 in North Carolina, and as we reported on Friday, now spreading to other districts in the state as well. And if I'm lucky, I will try to get to some of your calls on any and all of the above as well somehow today at 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. Write it down if you want to ring in and you care to get in line right now. But first, speaking of elections, as we do with no small amount of regularity on this on the Bradcast, throughout and since the 2018 midterm elections, we have been covering very closely the efforts by Georgia's former Republican Secretary of State, now Governor-elect Brian Kemp, to suppress the vote in his contest against popular African-American Democratic candidate Stacey Abrams. Following the very close election last month, Abrams formed a new nonprofit organization to file a lawsuit against the state of Georgia in an effort, in no small part, to prevent Kemp's appalling voter suppression tactics from being carried out by the new Secretary of State in the future, after they were used by Kemp against many African-American and other Democratic-leaning voters in 2018, as he oversaw his own election contest with Abrams in November. Also cited in Abrams' lawsuit and in a lot of our broadcast coverage leading up to and following the midterms, and in fact, for about 15 years prior to it, is the easily hacked, oft-failed, 100% unverifiable Diebold touchscreen voting systems still used across the entire swing state of Georgia. Many in the Peach State have been calling for a verifiable paper ballot system there. And in fact, prior to the election, a federal judge agreed with a federal lawsuit filed by the Nonpartisan Coalition of Good Governance that Georgia's voting systems were completely unreliable, completely vulnerable to manipulation, both from foreigners and insiders alike, and that they are completely unoverseeable by the public. And frankly, as the judge found, should never be used again in an election after the 2018 midterms. Now, even Georgia Republicans now, by and large, appear to favor what they describe as a paper ballot system for the state. But as we have been warning for many years now, a so-called paper ballot system, as opposed to a hand-marked paper ballot system, is not enough if we can't know that the candidate's selections on that paper are the ones actually intended by voters. Many Republicans in Georgia, including their new Republican Secretary of State-elect Brad Raffensperger, have joined with, in my opinion, too many Democrats, both there and elsewhere, to call for a new voting system which creates what they are calling a paper ballot, but it is one that is marked by a computer touchscreen device, which then prints out a paper ballot summary card with the voters' selections theoretically printed out, along with an unreadable barcode, which is then used by another computer, an optical scanner usually, to tabulate the results, all to avoid the much simpler and much cheaper and much more verifiable hand-marked paper ballot pen and paper system. The printed barcodes, of course, cannot be deciphered by humans, even though they are used to tally the results and are considered by some to be a human verifiable paper ballot. It isn't. As we tried to explain for a long time here, despite the growing support, not just in Georgia, but across the country, and yes, by many Democrats, for such a computer-marked paper ballot system. It's not just GOP-leaning jurisdictions like Georgia that are considering moving to these newfangled and still unverifiable touchscreen systems that, print computer paper summary cards for the voters or so-called ballot marking devices or BMDs. In key states like Pennsylvania and Texas, officials are moving towards these kind of systems made by the same private voting system vendors who have cashed in on billions of taxpayer dollars from the government with these systems to pawn off their flawed and failed unverifiable voting systems that, frankly, have been used in all 50 states for years. Even here in Los Angeles County now, believe it or not, the largest single voting jurisdiction in the nation, our own registrar recorder, County Clerk Dean Logan, has announced that LA County itself will be moving to a 100% unverifiable touchscreen-style ballot marking device at the polling place that produces a barcoded paper summary card with a human-readable summary of the voters' votes. But as we've also argued, it's impossible to know after an election whether any of those summary cards have actually been verified at all, much less correctly, by any voter. Computer scientists, at least some of them, are now trying to warn against the use of these computer ballot marking systems, even as many still somewhat misleadingly say that these ballot marking devices produce a paper ballot that can be reviewed by voters before they are cast and tallied. Well, last week in Georgia, a committee initially established by now Governor-elect Brian Kemp called the Secure, Accessible, and Fair Elections, or SAFE Commission, they met to decide whether the entire state should now move to a touchscreen computer-marked ballot system rather than a real hand-marked paper ballot system that produces ballots known to have been verified by voters before they're cast by their very nature, because the voter marked it themselves. The new Georgia system being considered is made by ES&S, the nation's largest private voting system vendor, and it would not be unlike the one now planned for use right here in my home county, L.A. County, before the crucial 2020 presidential election. Yes, that's what's coming to L.A. in 2020. All of that, even as a new scientific study by Georgia Tech computer scientists Richard DeMillo and Robert Cadell, with Marilyn Marks, a frequent guest here on the broadcast of the Coalition of Good Governance, as this new study finds, surprise, just as we have been trying to warn for about 15 years, most voters do not actually review their computer-marked paper ballot printouts, and more disturbingly, even if they do, they often do not notice when the computer has mismarked their ballots. Joining us now to discuss all of this is Richard DeMillo, one of the study's authors and now an outspoken proponent for actual verified voting. Richard DeMillo is a professor of computing and the former dean of computing at Georgia Tech, where he has directed Georgia Tech's Information Security Center. Prior to that, he was Hewlett-Packard's chief technology officer and held a leadership position at the National Science Foundation. His research contributions include computer security, cryptography, and software engineering. He has served on several different boards for cybersecurity and privacy companies and organizations, including the Verified Voting Foundation. And he has served as an election observer on behalf of the Carter Center, which is based in Atlanta. Professor Richard DeMillo, welcome to the broadcast, sir.
Hi, Brad.
I want to get to the findings of your important new study on how and if voters actually verify these computer-marked ballot summaries. But first, I know you were at the so-called Smart Commission hearing last week in Georgia, where the state is considering moving to these new systems across the entire state. How'd that hearing go, Richard?
Well, it was interesting. It was the first time that the commission had actually sought substantive input from Georgia citizens, and there were about 20 people that got up and gave 2-minute presentations on voter security and voter election integrity. I think the reaction was mixed. I think there are some people on the commission who understand the issues well and ask probing questions, but a surprising number that actually had not given much thought to what election integrity is all about and what these machines are capable of, or what the threat to elections might be.
Did you get a sense that the commissioners, the folks actually on the commission, and or the public actually understands and appreciates this difference that we're talking about? Because people hear paper ballots and they think, oh, great, we're all taken care of. Did the commissioners and the public understand the difference between a computer-marked paper ballot versus an actual verifiable hand-marked paper ballot?
I think once it's explained to people that you're imposing a computer between the act of marking the ballot and recording that vote, and that you don't have any visibility into what that computer is actually communicating to the tally machine in the background, they get it. Everyone who runs a personal computer in their home or has had a smartphone kind of go kablooey on them in the field understands that these machines are full of errors. They're easy to hack. They really would like some way of verifying that the vote that they cast is the vote that actually gets counted. But it takes a while to say that. And so if you're inclined to listen for a couple of minutes, you can get the message across to people. If as many of the commissioners were apparently predisposed to adopt whatever marketing information with ESNS provided, you get a different reaction. You get kind of a knee-jerk reaction, and that's generally true with the members of the commission, I think.
I've seen some of the defenders of the computer marked ballot idea in Georgia, arguing that a pen and paper ballot system would be simply too difficult for Georgia voters to use because they've been using these touchscreen systems for 15 years, which kind of blows my mind. But I'm interested to your response to that as a computer scientist who has spent years on the usability of such systems. Is there something in Georgia itself, is there something going on in Georgia that would make filling in an oval on a piece of paper more complicated there than it would anywhere else in the country?
You would think so from following the debate. I think there's a few things going on. One response that we get from people is that it's a step backwards to move to paper.
Mm-hmm.
We have these high-tech devices. Why can't we make them secure? Why can't we use them? It just seems really old-fashioned to move to pencil and paper.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes a while to talk through the issues with that. I have friends, I have relatives that ask why you can't do internet voting, why you can't vote on your smartphone. And it does take a while to talk people through the issues.
Oh, tell me about it. 15
yeah,
years.
And,
yeah, go ahead.
And there's another line of response that really has more to do with I think misrepresenting what the voters tell people. So you hear all the time, for example, voters don't want to vote with pencil and paper. Voters want the high tech devices, and there's actually no data to back that up. I mean, this is information that comes from the vendors,
mm-hmm.
Not from any scientific study. And you know, you mentioned the study that we did. Our approach here has been to kind of get to the heart of what the question is and adopt a why don't we find out attitude? Why don't we conduct an experiment? Why don't we gather the data and see what's actually going on?
And I want to talk about that study specifically, because I've been sort of waiting for that study for many years to come out. I've been making a similar argument that I think you find in your study. But I have been criticized over the years from time to time as a Luddite for not seeing the writing on the wall, that everything should be done with computers now. Given your credentials, Rich DeMillo, as a professor of computing and dean at Georgia Tech, et cetera. Has anyone tried to tar you with that particular criticism that, oh, you just need to get with it, you're old-fashioned, you're a Luddite, Rich DeMillo?
Yeah, the former Secretary of State thinks I'm a Luddite. I sent him my resume, so he knows my job history, but he seems to think that I don't know much about technology.
Oh, my God. Are you familiar with the system being prepared for use out here in L.A. County, which is being designed by the county itself? It's designed by the county. I think they're hiring vendors to build it for them. Theoretically, the county would own the source code, but it would still use touchscreens, tablet computers to produce a barcoded ballot summary card for tabulation. Have you been able to follow that effort out here in L.A.?
Yeah, we've been following what's going on out there.
Do you have the same concerns about the system that they are putting together for 2020 out here in L.A. as you do about the one they're looking at in Georgia?
I do. When you look at resystematizing any process, what you want to ask yourself is, has the cost-benefit study been done? And in the case of voting, particularly with barcodes,
mm-hmm.
you have to ask yourself, what is the purpose of the barcode? Why are we forget about the security of the situation? Why are we incurring the expense to provide barcode writers and readers for every polling place, every precinct in the county? They don't add any value to the process. It's no easier to cast or count votes using barcodes. The only thing that they do is obscure the actual vote from the voter who's looking at the barcode trying to decode it.
Proponents, of course, of those type of barcoded systems will argue that voters will be able to hold these computer-printed cards in their hand. They'll be able to study the printouts and look at this human-readable. It's a barcode and a human-readable summary in order to verify the accuracy of these ballot cards before they're cast into the optical scanner. But your new study offers some interesting data on that score. Professor Andrew Appel at Princeton University, a computer scientist there who frankly has hacked just about every electronic voting and tabulation system in existence. He cites your study to argue that voters should mark paper ballots by hand. Tell me what your study found and how you found it that led him to make that pronouncement.
Right. So we started with the question that you asked. Can an average person actually look at a paper ballot and verify that that is the ballot that he or she intended to cast? And it seems like a simple question, but it turns out to be not so simple when you put it to the test. There are a lot of reasons for asking that kind of question. Uh-huh. The psychology of how people remember things is in recent years come under a lot of attention for a variety of reasons. And we wanted to know when someone gets a printout that represents choices that they made a few seconds ago, how good are they at actually verifying that the receipt that they have is the set of choices that they made, and the answer is not very good, and it's not surprising that they're not very very good. And the longer the ballot is, the more difficult it is to remember what's happened. So we gave ballots to voters who were voting in the 2018 primary elections in Tennessee. Asked them whether or not the ballots that they were looking at were the ballots that they had cast just a few seconds ago, and the answer was no. They by and large couldn't do that. They did no better than random at deciphering whether or not the receipt that they had in front of them represented the ballots that they had cast.
So I'm clear on this, and this was in, I guess, Gatlinburg, Tennessee in May 2018. They used these computer-printed, barcoded BMD devices in that jurisdiction currently?
It is.
And so you said, your report says you showed them immediately after they deposited their ballot, you asked them to review an unvoted copy of the ballot that they voted on, meaning not the selections they made, but just the ballot itself, right? Are these the races you just voted on? Do I understand that correctly?
Right, because we couldn't kind of intercept them as they were voting. We had to be content with interviews after they had they had voted, but the experimental design tried to correct for that. So what we did was three things. One is we counted the number of people that actually checked their ballots, which is an interesting aspect of the experiment.
How many people did? Because I've often argued nobody checks these things after this long process on these systems. They print out the ballot and they don't actually review them.
Well, yeah, for all intents and purposes, that's true. The average person either doesn't check or gives the ballot card such a cursory reading that they couldn't possibly have had time to check the entries that they made. The average was 3.9 seconds for a ballot that had 18 choices on it.
3.9 seconds, that's how long they reviewed a ballot with 18 contests on it.
Right, right.
And half of them, you write, half of the voters did not even look at it at all. Is that right?
Right. That's
did we lose you?
Nope.
Oh, there we go. I didn't hear your answer there. You said you confirmed half of the voters don't even look at the printed ballot.
Half of them don't look at the ballots at all. Those that do give it by and large a cursory reading that wouldn't allow them to check it in any meaningful way.
And so then you showed them a copy of the ballot, just the races, and you said about 50% of them were able to identify when you had, I guess, changed or left off certain races off the ballot.
There were two tests that we gave them. One was, would they recognize the ballot that they had just voted? And so we gave them randomized, of course. We gave them either the ballot that they had just voted or a different ballot, and asked them to recognize it. And by and large, the results were random. It's a people mainly didn't recognize the ballot that they had just voted. And after we had done that, we then asked people in a separate test. We asked people to verify the ballot that they had voted.
Mm-hmm.
And what we gave them was a ballot with errors in it, either missing races or incorrect candidates. And they couldn't do that either. So no matter how you cut it, you're looking at a situation where the average voter is probably not going to be able to identify the choices that they had made.
I was speaking
in some cases, 10 seconds before.
Just 10 seconds before, and they still can. I was speaking with Marilyn Marks over the weekend, and your co-author on this study, and she pointed out that, in essence, these new systems, they're basically requiring every voter to sort of test the system to see if it's working or not after every single vote, and that is, by and large, an unfair burden to place on voters, not to mention it raises the question about what the hell they can do about it, since this is all happening during the actual election, even if they do find a problem. I had a similar case myself back in 2008, and I used one of these ballot marking devices. It actually misprinted 4 out of 12 of my own votes, and I looked at that ballot for 20 minutes trying to decide, did I screw it up? Was this my fault? Did I, you know, do I want to go through the whole process again? Is that essentially, do you agree with Marilyn's assessment here, that we're actually asking voters to beta test the system in the middle of an election?
I think it's a brilliant analogy. You know, the stakes have changed from 2002, when we thought we were asking for something really simple by asking for a voter verifiable paper ballot. They've changed to the test that you just described. We're now asking individual voters to conduct tests of the correctness of the machine that they just voted on. And we hide information from them, so they can't actually do that in a fair way. That is an unfair burden on the voter.
And not to mention, you know, in this case, even if they do verify the human readable portion, that's not the portion that's actually tabulated by the system. They use the unreadable barcode, right?
That is the point of this. That if the machine is compromised, then both things that are printed on that receipt come from the same bad seed. They come from the compromised machine. They come from malware that's sitting on a computer somewhere, printing out this ballot summary. And the software would know whether or not the outputs were supposed to match or not, and it could make it look however they wanted. It could make it so that the English language description was accurate and the barcode was inaccurate, or it could make it so it matched, or some percentage of the time it could randomize things so it would pull some statistical algorithm that was looking see whether or not the machines have been compromised.
And finally, Rich DeMillo, as I've been trying to say, even if everything is printed by the computer correctly as per the voter's intent, and even if they are able to check the ballot and notice that there are problems or not, or that everything is fine with these computer-printed ballots, there is no way to know after an election if any of those ballots has actually been verified correctly or otherwise by the voters. Doesn't that, by its very definition, harm the confidence in the results?
Right, and what we're looking at here is a situation where there is just, from a mathematical standpoint, not enough independently sourced pieces of information to be able to make those kinds of determinations. You know, when we talk about hand-marked paper ballots and post-election audits, we take into account the fact that these hand-marked paper ballots will be scanned by computers. The computers could presumably be compromised. We want to know, do the totals match the votes cast?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's two pieces of independent information. You can do that. You can conduct a post-election audit to determine that. But as soon as I throw another computer into the mix, a barcode writer or a barcode reader, for example, I've screwed up all the math. And there's no way that you can come up with a statistically meaningful audit in that kind of environment. And these are all problems that we've created for ourselves. The only reason we're having this discussion is that someone has decided that having an expensive pen to mark a ballot is more important than the transparency of the election process itself. As soon as you get rid of that ballot marking devices, the universe goes back to normal, the mathematics works out, we can conduct auditable elections in a much more secure and verifiable way.
And last question here, Rich, just to be crystal clear, as a guy who has spent a career in computer science and security and software design and so forth, your recommendations for a new voting system, whether it is in Georgia or Pennsylvania or Texas or L.A. County or anywhere else in the U.S. where they may be considering, where they are considering new voting systems, what would you tell them to do?
Hand mark paper ballots. If the precinct is sufficiently large, optical scans or mark sense scanners to tally things in a post-election audit before election certification to determine that the totals match.
Hand-marked paper ballots. Rich DeMillo, greatly appreciate the work that you're doing in Georgia. It's quite crucial and greatly appreciated. I'll point folks to your study. Rich DeMillo is professor of computing and the former dean of computing at Georgia Tech, where he has directed Georgia Tech's Information Center. He has also served on the board of the Verified Voting Foundation. We'll link to them as well. Professor, greatly appreciate you joining us today on the broadcast, sir.
Thank you, Brad.
You bet. All right, let's take a quick break here, and we'll come back with some more news of the day. And if you have any questions or concerns about this, yes, I got to remind you, this is where we are going here in L.A. County, touchscreen ballot marking devices. Give me a call if you like. I'll try to answer and clarify as needed. I know we've got a lot of listeners in the LA County area who may be surprised to learn that we are headed towards this sort of a computer marked touchscreen system in so-called progressive Los Angeles. And I suspect our registrar recorder out here, Dean Logan, who we've had on the show several times over the years, not lately, since he has not taken me up of late for some invitations to be on this show. I hope he'll join us in the future. I suspect he might love to hear from you with your opinions about the new system that he has been planning and working on for about 5 years now. A listener, Desi Doyen, you say a listener called in to ask how we can organize voter opposition to stop this BMD system in LA.
Yes, she was hoping that maybe there was some way that voters could stand up and say, no, nuh-uh, we don't want this.
You know what? Contact the registrar recorder out here in L.A. County. Other than that, yes, please organize. I'm busy doing a daily radio show. Otherwise, I would lead that charge. I've been trying to get this message out for years now about this this coming system. We do need some organization if this is going to be stopped here in the nation's largest voting jurisdiction.
Yeah, and as you say, with it being the nation's largest voting jurisdiction, there's a great deal of incentive for other states to pick up what LA has already developed.
Yep.
So I suppose that would be the same answer for people in other states to pay attention to what your Secretary of State and especially your county boards of elections are setting up for selections for you to vote on.
Especially with Democrats. That's in Congress. Years ago, I spoke with Congressman Rush Holt, who told me directly on the phone, Brad, I would like every voter in the country to cast a vote on a BMD. And he is literally a rocket scientist. And I tried to explain how insane this was. Now we at least have a little bit more ammunition in this newly released study from DeMillo et al. Anyway, my phone number is 818-985-5735 if you'd like to ring in on that. I got a bunch of other news to cover as well. That is all coming up on the broadcast after a quick break. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't touch that dial. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. We will get to your phone calls momentarily at 818-985-5735. That is coming up, whether you got questions or concerns about the touchscreen computer ballot marking devices coming to a jurisdiction near you, whether you're in L.A. or Texas or Georgia or Pennsylvania or Tennessee or beyond. Very quickly, a federal George W. Bush-appointed judge in Texas late on Friday struck down the entire Affordable Care Act, better known as Obamacare, on the grounds that it is unconstitutional because the mandate requiring people to buy health care, health insurance, is itself unconstitutional, and therefore the rest of the law cannot stand without it. When the Supreme Court upheld that mandate, as constitutional back in 2012, it was based on Congress's taxing power. Congress said that the court, Congress could legally impose a tax penalty on people who do not have health insurance. But in the new case, the plaintiffs, led by Texas, argued that with the penalty now zeroed out by Congress in last year's GOP-Trump tax cuts, the individual mandate had become unconstitutional, and therefore the rest of the law was somehow unconstitutional as well. If this decision stands, about 17 million Americans will lose their health insurance, according to the Urban Institute. That includes millions who gained coverage through the law's expansion of Medicaid, and millions more who received subsidized private insurance through the law's online marketplaces. Insurers will also no longer have to cover young adults up to the age of 26 under their parents' plans. Annual and lifetime limits on coverage will again be permitted. There will then also be no cap on out-of-pocket costs to you and I, the consumers. Also gone will be the law's popular protections for people with pre-existing conditions. Without those protections, insurers could then return to denying coverage to such people or charging them more. They could also return to charging people more based on their age, their gender, or their profession. The Kaiser Family Foundation, nonpartisan research organization, finds that 52 million adults would be rejected for coverage under the practices that were in effect in most states before the Affordable Care Act. If this law is struck down, which Donald Trump lauded over the weekend when the judge made this ruling on Friday night. Larry Leavitt, the senior VP at the Kaiser Family Foundation, tweeted, "If this Texas decision on the ACA is upheld, it would throw the individual insurance market and the whole U.S. healthcare system into complete chaos." But he notes the case still has a long legal road to travel before that becomes an immediate threat. So this decision will be appealed. It could make its way all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. That'll take a while. So for the moment, all you need to know is that nothing has actually changed. For now, or for this year, your insurance coverage will not change due to whatever George W. Bush appointed judge decided on Friday. And while the federal open enrollment period for Obamacare for 2019 on healthcare.gov, that ended over the weekend. However, there are still some states that run their own exchanges and are you can still sign up there for the next year, including out here in California, which, along with Connecticut, actually extended the enrollment period a bit over the weekend. Both Connecticut and California made this announcement. They're extending their deadline in Connecticut out by a full month. Now you can still sign up for the Federal Affordable Care Act and the subsidies that go with it. Some people are paying $0 for health care coverage in Connecticut until January 15 now. Covered California, that's California's version of the ACA, was already, the deadline was already in January 15. But the deadline to enroll for coverage that begins on January 1st was originally that was going to end over the weekend. They have now extended that by 5 more days. So if you want coverage beginning January 1 in California, you can still do it until Friday, December 21. At the Covered California site. The also in Colorado, open enrollment runs through mid-January. In Washington, D.C. and New York, enrollment runs through the end of January. In Massachusetts, you can still sign up through January 23. In Minnesota, open enrollment runs through January 13. In Rhode Island, you can sign up through December 31st of this year. So if you go to healthcare.gov, that will link to any of the state-run exchanges where you can sign up. Thought you'd want to know. Our phone number is 818-985-5735. If you have thoughts about our last segment, about this, or about the stuff I'm going to talk about in a second, you can reach me, 818-985-KPFK. Let's fire it off with our old friend Mo in Long Beach. Hey, Morris, welcome to the broadcast, sir. What you got for me today, brother?
Well, Brad, you know we can solve this problem with the voting machines and all that if we wanted to. I use my debit card, and them folks know what I bought, when I bought it, who I bought it from. I mean, it really can be that simple.
Well, but that's not a solution, Morris. We don't want everyone to know who you voted for. We have a secret ballot in voting. That's why it's kind of more complicated than just, you know, buying something with your credit card.
A lot of things happen in darkness, Brad, I'm telling you. And if these folks really wanted to address our voting situation here, how come they're not talking to Greg Pollard? How come they're not talking to people like you, Brad? And how come they're not talking to my boy Chris Kobach? You know, they were talking about how the Russians, they keep using the same vernacular, meddling in the election, meddling in the elections. I'm going to ask you a question, Brad, and I'm serious. Mm-hmm. Straight up. Who do you think had a greater impact on the election, Chris Kobach or the Russians?
Well, Chris Kobach, in his case, he's the was the Secretary of State of Kansas. I guess he still is for a few more days. He was running for governor, and he lost. He was rejected. The Republican candidate for governor was rejected in deep red Kansas. Who had more of an effect on the election? I see what you're getting at, but I can't tell you the answer, Morris. It's two new studies out today that I was hoping to get to in a moment. Maybe I'll try to get to them shortly here. Show that there was, in fact, a pretty huge influence operation on the American elections before, during, and after the 2016 race. And in fact, African Americans specifically were covered more than anyone else, at least disproportionately more so, by this effort. You don't think that had an effect on the electorate, Mo?
This is how I see it. The Russians, what they did was mental. What Chris Kobach did was physical. Major difference. Chris Kobach should be in prison. Sometimes I listen to the little D's. I call them Democrats, the little D Democrats. Mm-hmm. When they say, well, our democracy should be protected, our democracy. Well, how come y'all ain't having an arrest warrant sent out for people like Chris Kobach and stuff like that? I hope the Mueller investigation, it can go about pretty much anywhere, like when they investigated Nixon for the White House investigation. Mm-hmm. This thing can go anywhere. I hope they go there too, Brad. Because, you know, Martin Luther King once said something. He said, you know, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. And back in the day when folks like myself couldn't vote, everybody was cool because they could vote. Now their votes are being threatened. So we got to look out for people we don't like sometimes, because one day that same spirit might be at our doorstep.
You're damn right. Thanks, Morris. I appreciate that call. And you're right. We fight for absolutely everybody's right to vote on this show, no matter who they may be voting for or against, or even if they're not voting at all. Yes, you have a right to not vote if you want, and we will fight to protect that right. Our phone number is 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. And as long as he mentioned the Mueller investigation and Nixon and Trump and everything else, I will point you towards a new article cited by Lawrence Tribe today, the great Harvard constitutional law professor at bradblog.com, written by our friend and a legal analyst, Ernie Canning, over there, saying that, in fact, Donald Trump can and should be indicted as even as sitting president of the United States if he if he is found to have committed a crime, a felony, and that just because he's president does not mean he should be allowed to escape justice by being criminally indicted. He explains why in that article at bradblog.com. We talked about it a little bit on last Friday's show. I think on Friday's show. Am I right about that? Who did we talk? Who was our guest? I can't remember any. You can't remember either, can
I know.
You?
I was just having a total brain fart on that.
Let me find out. Well, when you can let me know who was our guest on the last broadcast, boy, you think we're ready for Christmas? Well, we'll come through with that breaking news. Otherwise, you can download it at bradblog.com and read Ernie Canning's article over there. In some other news here, over the weekend, Interior Department Secretary Ryan Zinke. Greg Holman.
Craig Holman. Yeah. Of the...
Where from?
I'm trying to remember now.
Public Citizen.
Thank
that
you.
Part
Public
I remembered.
Citizen.
I can't believe you
this
didn't...
This is terrible.
Yeah,
I know.
You need a break.
Sorry
as well.
About that, folks.
Yeah. Fail. All right. Over the weekend, as I said, Ryan Zinke apparently submitted his resignation to the White House. The Interior Department secretary, he has been long facing intense pressure to step down because of the multiple probes tied to his real estate dealings in his home state of Montana and his conduct in office. Another member of Donald, I only hire the best people, Trump's swamp team going down months after he already should have, been fired for being wildly corrupt in his post, not to mention for his fossil-fueled attack on the nation's interior as the Interior Department secretary. The White House, according to Washington Post, has been pushing Zinke to resign for weeks. And apparently last month they told him he had until the end of the year or he was going to be fired. The key moment apparently was in his loss of support at the White House came back in October when Interior's Inspector General referred one of its inquiries to the Justice Department for a criminal investigation. That probe, which continues, is examining whether a land deal that Zinke struck with the chair of the oil services giant Halliburton in his hometown of Whitefish, Montana, whether that constituted a conflict of interest. Oh, you think? Zinke blamed his departure in a private resignation letter on, quote, vicious and politically motivated attacks. I suspect Desi Doyen, you'll have more on Green News Report tomorrow.
Yes, I fully plan to have more on that on the Green News Report tomorrow. But I will add that, you know, his discussion about how he said, quote, in his statement, quote, after 30 years of public service, I cannot justify spending thousands of dollars defending myself and my family against these false allegations. And most people, including me, are looking at that as a translating that as he's facing all of these investigations. And also an incoming Congress full of Democrats, especially in the House, where they've regained the majority, who were planning to actually make him answer questions. So he's heading for the exit.
Yes, he is. And I can hardly blame him. All right. We'll take a quick Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer said Ryan Zinke was one of the most toxic members of the cabinet. In the way he treated our environment, our precious public lands, and the way he treated the government like it was his personal honeypot, the swamp cabinet, will be a little less foul without him, said Schumer. All right, quick break, and we're back with more news from the past few days here, some election news, some election fraud news, and if I have time, your calls at 818-985-5735. I'm Brad Friedman. This is the Bradcast. Welcome back to the Bradcast and the Radio Goo Goo and Gaga from me, Brad Friedman. Thank you for sticking with us here. We've got some more calls ahead. 818-985-5735 is our phone number. Actually, let me get right to Herbert in Norwalk. Hey, Herb, welcome to the Bradcast, sir.
Yeah, Brad, Brad, you got my hackles up. I don't agree with you at all about people having the right not to vote.
Mm-hmm.
We send people off to wars to get killed and maimed for their right to vote. And like in the back last big election, 50% of the people that should have voted didn't even vote. So we get 23% put somebody like Trump in office, which is not a mandate. And then also, I think there should be at least 75% of the people that can vote must vote to get a mandate. And then if they don't vote, they should do like they do in Australia, fine them $50 for not voting.
So you don't think they have a right? Now, would they have a right if they're forced to vote, if it's mandated voting, they don't have a right to protest by not voting? Do they have a right to, do they show up? Can they not make a selection on the ballot as far as you're concerned?
No, there has to be a vote. They have to vote one way or another. Whatever way they want to vote, that's their privilege. But to actually not vote is not a privilege. It's just like you have responsibilities to pay bills and other things, but in deference to people that go off to wars to give them the right to vote, they should have to vote.
Well, let me challenge you a little bit, Herb, if you don't mind. First, you described the vote as a privilege. I would argue it is not a privilege. I would argue it is a right.
It's not a privilege.
It's a right.
It's a requirement.
Well, it's not a requirement either. You'd like to see it as such, but this is a right to vote, not a privilege to vote. You don't have to earn it, correct?
Well, right now, yeah. I mean,
it's
whether you want to or not, but I'm saying that it should be required.
I understand what you're. No, I understand what you're saying. Should people who have had that right taken away in jail, for instance, should they be required to vote as well?
Yes.
Okay.
Anybody that's qualified to vote should be required to vote.
Okay. And you have said several times here that this right to vote, you call it a privilege, but the right to vote was won by people overseas fighting wars overseas.
Sending our people overseas to fight for their right to vote.
We're sending people overseas to fight for others' rights to vote in other countries.
Wars,
yeah.
You know, they're always telling us that that we fight these wars to protect our rights, our constitution, and all that, and that's what gives them the right to vote.
Yeah, well, I might give them the right to vote, but our right to vote, I would argue, is inherent here.
I'm talking about Americans fighting wars, and our leaders tell us we're fighting these wars to protect our Constitution and our rights to vote.
Yeah, and of course, I don't buy them. I think they're full of it. Let me ask you this, Herb. I mean, that's not why we're actually fighting these wars.
No, I know that.
Yeah.
You know that.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, the fact that people are dying to protect this country so that it doesn't get overrun by other governments that wouldn't want us to vote, or maybe take the vote away totally.
Yeah, I know. I just hate to give so much credit, frankly, to the troops. I think there's a hell of a lot of people protecting our democracy. I understand that, Herb. Let me ask you very quickly before I let you go. If we had a compromise that, yes, it was a mandated requirement to vote, but there was an option in every race for none of the above, and if none of the above won, then we'd have...
I would love that. That's another thing that I've thought about many times.
All right.
If we got none of the above... Too many people voted none of the above. They would have to go back to the drawing board and put people up there that were worthy of voting for.
Okay, Herb, I think we have found common ground. I'm with you. We'll do that if there is a right for none of the above in every race. Hey, thanks, Herbert. Yeah.
The other option is they pay $50 for not voting.
Yeah, I know. I'm not crazy about that idea. Thanks, Herb. I appreciate the call, brother. Let me get, do I have time for one more? I do. Sasha in L.A., welcome to the broadcast, Sasha.
Thank you for taking my call. I guess you might have been waiting for that answer, or Desi tipped you off to my...
answer is that?
To Nota, none of the above.
Oh, none of the above. But, no, I've been. That has been my compromised position for a long time. I think people have the right not to vote, but I'm, if nothing, if not a compromiser.
Yeah, and Ralph Nader did it. You know, he tried to get this on the ground in California about 21 years ago with the Oaks Project.
Mm-hmm.
And I was, you know, really out there trying to help make it happen. Unfortunately, it didn't really take root. But, you know, maybe now we could do something like that. And I think it's more potent than just giving people, I mean, the illusion that, well, they're accomplishing something by exercising their right to not vote. This gives your vote some teeth.
Yeah.
You know, if you want to vote and say none of the above and it really counts, then, you know.
Yeah, if none of the above wins, then start over from scratch. I'm okay with that. I appreciate your thoughts there, Sasha.
As Ralph Nader always said, it would send them packing. You know,
there you go. Unfortunately,
get rid of those candidates.
Yeah,
you know?
I know, but you know, it takes a few decades before anybody pays attention. Unfortunately, to Ralph Nader, sadly.
Thanks for being there.
You bet. Thank you, Sasha. IT manager here at KPFK, Jonathan, puts in a note here to say, "Why do soldiers need to go to war so I can vote? Who has an army and is using it to take away my vote?" Yeah, good point. Thank you, Jonathan. I appreciate that. My update on the North Carolina GOP election fraud scheme in North Carolina that is still unfolding, still expanding. That update's going to have to wait till tomorrow. On our next thrilling broadcast, which I hope you will join me for. Until then, my thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, to my board operator, D'Angelo Jones, and to my guest today, Professor Richard DeMillo of Georgia Tech and the Verified Voting Foundation. If you missed any portion of today's show, download it anytime at bradblog.com. Drop me email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. On the Facebooks and the Twitters, I am The Brad Blog. That's it. Until we meet again tomorrow, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.